It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Just reminding you kids of that phrase may strike fear in your hearts as you anticipate the literature final exam. Many of you are familiar with that quote, "The best of times, the worst of times," the opening line from Charles Dickens' novel, A Tale of Two Cities, which many of you probably read in high school literature or college literature. The best of times, the worst of times, it's an appropriate summary, not just of the days of the French Revolution that Dickens was writing about, but of the days that we live in as well. Maybe not just the days that the world is in right now, but maybe your life. And you say, life is so frustrating because sometimes it's the best of times and then I wake up the next day and it's the worst of times. Why can't it just stay the same for at least a few weeks or a few years? So true, sometimes life seems good and the good days seem to outnumber the bad days. Sometimes life seems bad. To quote another famous work, maybe not so literary as Dickens' novel, but I like that song in the cartoon Robin Hood, as they're singing of the despair that is set into Nottingham. Sometimes the ups outnumber the downs, but not in Nottingham. And some of you may feel that way, like the rooster strumming on the guitar. For some people, the ups outnumber the downs, but not for me. Not in the city where I live. Why is life sometimes so good and life sometimes seems so bad and so tough? God, in His sovereignty, allows both good and bad times for our good. Because good times, as well as bad times, provide an opportunity to respond either wisely or to respond foolishly. And if the truth be told, many times in my life, in the bad times, I respond foolishly. Chapter 6, in verse 12 of Ecclesiastes, has asked us the question, who knows what's good for a man? Who knows what's going to happen after your life? Only God knows what's good for a man, and He's revealed it to us here through Solomon. And so he plays on this key word of good. Sometimes it's translated in English, better. Better is something than this. He's answering the question, what's good for a person? And last Sunday we saw that it's actually good for a person to go to a funeral, because funerals cause us to think about our own funeral and how we are living. But he tells us four more truths this morning in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 about what's good for us. So if you're not already there in your Bibles, please turn there. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, where he answers the question, what's good for us? And the short answer is this: God knows what's good for you. So let Him do what He wants to do. On a side note, it's not like we could stop it if we tried. Occasionally we hear folks say something like, well, I don't want to surrender my life to God because then He might call me to be a missionary. He might really mess up my life. If God wanted to mess up your life, He doesn't need your permission to do it. But He's not interested in messing up your life. Solomon tells us this morning that the good He allows in our life and the bad are both for our good. And we need to respond appropriately. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 5. Solomon tells us it's better, it's good to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of a thorn bush under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. This too is vanity. Repression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. He says, first of all, that it's good to listen to wise people, not to fools. It's good to listen to wise people, not to fools. And he kind of continues the theme that he's raised in the first few verses of chapter 7 and then ties it into a bow and leaves it. But he says there, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. How many of us like to hear rebuke? I don't. I don't like it when somebody rebukes me. Say a mom tells her teenage son, I'm concerned that your friend is being a poor influence on you and you're not going to be able to hang out with him until that changes. Or a dad sees his daughter about to leave the house in immodest clothes and tells her, I'm sorry, honey, but your clothes aren't modest. You'll have to change before you go out. That's a rebuke that's hard to hear. Or a parent tells their elementary age child, your attitude's not good. That needs to change. Or you're not treating your brother and sister right today, and that needs to change. That rebuke is hard to hear. Or maybe a church member tells another church member, you're not the same person you used to be. You're changing. I don't know what's going on, but I'm concerned about where you're headed. Or a wife lovingly appeals to her husband. A pastor confronts a church member, you need to get this bitterness out of your life. It's going to destroy you. Or one church member goes to another church member, I think you're making an unwise decision in this area. Or a friend sees another friend's Facebook post and confronts them lovingly and says, I'm not sure that you should be posting things like that. Rebukes. And our natural inclination is to say, no, thank you. You take care of your life, I'll take care of mine. But Solomon says it's good to hear the rebuke of a wise person. Rebukes are good things. It's easy for us to see this with other people's kids, isn't it? You're at the mall, or you're out shopping, you're out at the park, and you see a kid that is not getting rebuked. Or if they are getting rebuked, they're getting beat up or they're getting yelled at. Occasionally, we'll see a family out, and the kid is just a terror. And I'll tell my kids something like, that's what happens when parents don't obey the Bible. It's easy to see with other people's kids. It's harder for us to receive it when somebody comes to us. We expect kids to be taught. We don't want to be taught, or at least not by a rebuke. According to God, rebukes are good for us if we listen to them. But rebukes are kind of like a double-edged sword. If you listen to them, you respond, you make wise decisions based on the rebuke, you become wiser. But if godly friends rebuke you and you don't respond to it, you always become harder and harder and harder. There's no middle ground with a rebuke. If you listen and change, you become wiser. If you don't listen, you do change. You just get changed to be harder. And I'm concerned for those in this room that are getting harder because you won't listen to a rebuke. And you're changing, but you're not changing for the better. And it's sad to see. He says it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise person than it is to hear the song of fools. Now, what's the song of fools? Maybe think of a backyard barbecue where a bunch of unsaved adults are gathered to eat and to drink. Before long, you'll begin to hear the song of fools. Or a rave with hundreds of teens dancing. You'll hear the song of fools, or run down the Billboard 100. You'll hear the song of fools. There is a song of fools, but our human hearts like to listen to the song of fools. Why? Because they might make us laugh. They might be enjoyable. It might prevent us from thinking about reality for a little bit to escape the problems of our world. I think that's why so many people just constantly have noise going into their head, because they're trying to cover up and escape the reality of the problems of their world. He says you can escape for reality for a little while, but that's not going to help you. A rebuke from a wise friend hurts for a little bit, but it helps in the long run if you listen to it. So he makes the comparison in verse 6 that the song of fools is like the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot. I've never tried this before, but it'd be an interesting experiment. Try and start a fire with thorn bushes or thistles. Apparently what'll happen is they'll make an impressive display of sound, but very little heat. You're not going to warm your food up. It's going to be short-lived. It's impressive, but it doesn't help. That's the point of a song of a fool. It's impressive. It catches your attention. Maybe makes a wonderful sound for a little bit. But it doesn't change anything. It doesn't help anything. What you need and what I need is the rebuke of a friend. Have you ever thought about praying this? Honestly, I can't say I've ever thought about this. What would it be like for us to pray to the Lord, "Lord, would you let godly people rebuke me so that I can become wise?" Say, "Wow, that's making me so vulnerable." Yeah, it is. But that would be an appropriate prayer for somebody who takes seriously that it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man. Somebody who comes and says, "God, I've got blind spots. I know I've got blind spots. I just don't know what they are. Would you let a godly friend, would you let my parents, would you let my pastor, would you let my spouse, would you let my kids, would you let a fellow church member lovingly come to me in the right attitude and point that out so that I can grow and so that I can change?" Look at what he says in verse 7. He says we've got to be so careful about putting ourselves under the influence of fools, because even wise people can be adversely affected by fools. That's his point in verse 7. He says oppression makes a wise man mad. Oppression in the Old Testament deals with money being stolen or extorted from you, or property being stolen from you. And he says, you can tempt a wise man to act foolishly by setting him up for oppression. Somebody takes his money, he loses money in a bad investment. She gets ripped off by somebody that's a friend, they thought. Says, you can tempt a wise person to act like a fool. Look at the end of verse 7. He says, a bribe, literally a gift, but I think he's talking about a bribe. A bribe can corrupt the heart. Literally, a bribe destroys the heart. A bribe can tempt even a wise person to act foolishly. When we were in India, the believers over there, as I was traveling around with John would describe to me how corrupt their police system was, and it's based solely on bribes, primarily on bribes. So if a policeman pulls you over in India, you don't want to get written up for a ticket, you got to pay a bribe. Well, a bribe can cause even wise people to make very bad decisions. And Solomon's point is that you do not want the influence of a fool in your life, somebody who's going to try and bribe you, somebody who might oppress you. As one man puts it, even a wise person can be made a fool when money's involved. When money gets involved, even the most godly among us can be tempted to make foolish choices. So he says, don't hang around with fools. You don't want to be put in that place of temptation. He says, it's better, it's good to listen to the wise, but not listen to fools. Let me ask you, young people, are your friends wise or are they fools? Solomon says in Proverbs that if you walk with wise men, you will be wise, but a companion of fools will be destroyed. Listen to the wise, not to fools. What influences the way that you think? It amazes me how advertisers will spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to buy a short little ad to try and influence the way you think and what you will do. And sometimes it baffles me. Do these advertisements really work? Why are they wasting so much money on advertising? But they must work because they keep doing them. We are so easily influenced. That's why we must guard that our primary influences in life are from wise people, not fools. Second thing that's good for us there in verse 8. He says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Don't be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? It's not from wisdom that you ask about this. Secondly, he tells us that it's better, it's good to be patient, not angry. It's good to be patient, not angry. He says, better is the end of a matter than its beginning. We could illustrate it by what he's just covered in verses 5 to 7. It's better to get rebuked by a friend because in the end it's going to make you a wise person if you respond to it. It's hard to swallow at first, but it can lead to a great outcome. Sometimes we're in a difficult situation, what we would call one of those bad days, and Solomon says, it's okay. Wait, be patient. Don't get angry about what God has allowed in your life. The end will be better than the beginning if you respond right. He says the end of a matter is better than the beginning. And patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. That word haughty has the idea of something that's high, or we would say proud. A high view of yourself. What does Solomon tell us about ourselves if we have a high view of ourselves? He says if you have a high view of yourself, you're probably not a patient person. Or to say it the other way, if I'm an impatient person, I'm a proud person. You can't be proud and patient. It's one or the other for us as believers. Pride and patience don't go together. So the more humble I am, the more patient I will be. The more humble you are, the more patient you will be. How's that? Well, a proud person says, this shouldn't be happening to me. I deserve better. This person should not be treating me this way. God should not be allowing this in my life, and it's pride. A proud person says, I don't deserve this. So in verse 9, he tells us what a proud person is. He says a proud person is angry. He says in verse 9, don't be eager or hasty in your heart to be angry, to be easily provoked to anger. He says, don't be quick to get angry, to be easily provoked to anger. Why not? What's the problem with somebody who loses his cool or loses her cool quickly or blows up or yells at somebody? What's the problem with that? Well, the problem is it reveals what I am. And according to God, he says at the end of verse 9, he says, anger rests in the bosom of fools. What's your bosom? Your bosom is here. What's the point? You can't see into somebody's bosom, not if they're healthy. You can't see what's going on deep down, but you want to know what's going on deep down? Look at whether they're angry or not. Because he says, deep down, a fool is an angry person, an impatient person. A fool is one who's proud and impatient, who gets easily upset, who gets easily provoked. At your workplace, would your coworkers describe you as a patient person? If they give out awards for the employee of the month, would you ever get an award for being the most patient employee? Or do you have a reputation for, well, don't cross so-and-so. Stay on their good side. You ever know those people that as long as you're on their good side, everything's kosher, but you know that if you do one thing wrong, look out. Would your coworkers describe you as a patient person? Let's get a little closer to home. Husbands, would your wife describe you as a patient person? Oh, you say, wait a second, Pastor Michael, that's getting way too personal. I know. But I am a husband, so I got to ask myself that question. Would my wife or would my kids describe me as a patient person? Moms, would your kids consider you to be patient? Kids, if I were to ask your brothers and sisters, would they tell me that you're a patient person? Or do you get easily irritated and upset and run off to mom? Mom, so-and-so did this. And maybe most importantly, would God say that you're a patient person? Because I can probably fake you, fool you for a while, but I can't fool God. So he says in verse 10, he says, don't say this. Why is it the former days were better than these? Impatient people are always looking back to the good old days. Sometimes we call it nostalgia, and sometimes it is good nostalgia. But sometimes it's nothing more than impatience with what God has allowed in my life right now. If I was just out of this mess, and if I could just be back to when I was a kid, or when I was a teenager, or early in marriage, if I could just be back there, then I could get out of this mess that I'm in now. Probably a reflection of my impatience and my anger with God. Solomon is driving us back to the reality that the end is the better than the beginning. He says it's not from wisdom that you ask about this. Why? Because the present has enough challenges to face. Life today and tomorrow and the next day needs my full attention and the grace of God. And if I'm wishing I was in the past, if I'm wishing I could go back to the good old days, I won't face the present in the right way. Because as we think about it, the past had lots of problems too. It's just easy to gloss over them and long for the good old days. He says, don't get angry about present circumstances that God has allowed in your life. Be content. Be patient. Because secondly, it's better to be patient than it is to be angry. What's good for us? He tells us a third thing that's good for us in verses 11 and 12. He says, wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. Verse 12, for wisdom is protection just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. He says it's better, it's good to have wisdom with an inheritance. He's saying it's good to have an inheritance. That's nice. But he says it's better to have wisdom with an inheritance and its advantage to you here in this life under the sun. Why is wisdom so vital for those who receive an inheritance? Verse 12 is the explanation. Because wisdom is protection just like money is protection. He says money is protection. How does money protect you? Well, it can protect you from starving because you can buy food. Can protect you from freezing to death in the winter because you can buy a house or rent a house to keep you warm. Money, in one sense, is a protection, but it's limited protection. He says wisdom is a protection just like money is a protection. And this word that's translated protection here is the word that literally is a shadow. You say, what does that mean? Well, on a hot day, which we're all hoping for very soon. On a hot day, if we ever get one, where do you want to go to get out of the heat, to get protection from the sun? You go under a tree or under a little gazebo, somewhere where you have a shadow. That's the idea of this word. Wisdom is like a shadow, a shade, a protection for you. To protect you from something that's undesirable. And he says money is protection, but he says it's so much better to have money and wisdom because wisdom is an even better protection than money is. Why? The end of verse 12 explains. He says the advantage, the profit of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. He uses knowledge and wisdom basically as synonyms here. What's knowledge? Knowledge is what you gain by experience in the Christian life. It's not, can you do your mathematical tables? Can you remember who wrote A Tale of Two Cities on your final exam? That's a good kind of knowledge to have. He's talking here about godly knowledge gained by experience, maturity gained by experience as a believer, wisdom, skill, and living. You say, how on earth would I ever get that? Pastor Michael, I want that. Flip back to chapter 2. Chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. And it tells us who gets God's wisdom and knowledge. Chapter 2 and verse 26, Solomon says, "For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy." So how do you increase in knowledge and wisdom? By being a godly person. He says, if you're a godly person, God will progressively give you more and more wisdom and knowledge. You'll get wiser and wiser. And this wisdom will be a protection to you because it's better than money in the sense that it can preserve the life of its possessor. Wisdom can preserve your life. What does that mean? Solomon is constantly warning his sons in the book of Proverbs, if you live like a fool, if you live in immorality, if you do these things, you will probably die a premature death. You will probably die before your time. Not in the sense of God's sovereignty, but as we look at from a human perspective, this person could have lived so much longer, but they made foolish choices that led to a premature death. And he says, money can't keep you from making those foolish choices. In fact, money will actually increase your temptation to make foolish choices. Money cannot keep you from making foolish choices that will lead to a premature death, but godly wisdom will. Money can't preserve your life other than giving you the resources to buy food and to put a roof above your head, but godly wisdom and knowledge can keep you from dying the premature death of a fool. And that's why he says, number three, it's good to be wise, not just rich. It's good to be wise, not just rich. Now, Solomon was both. And if God gives you the best of both worlds, fantastic. But if you only have one, it's much better to be wise than it is to be rich. It's good to be wise, not just rich. But there's one more truth that he wants to drive home about what's good for us. And that's in verses 13 to 14. He says, consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent or made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. So he says, here, let me give you an illustration. Look at the work of God. Think about God's work. Consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? He's asking us the question, are you in control, Michael? Do you even know what's going to happen in the future? Chapter 3, verse 11, he says that man will not find out the work that God has done from beginning to end. Chapter 8, verse 17, he says, I saw every work of God. I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Chapter 11, verse 5, he says, you do not know the work or the activity of God who makes all things. He says, you can't figure out what God's up to unless He reveals it to you in His Word. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. You don't know what's going to happen after you. He says, think about the work of God. Think about what God's doing in the world. Can you change what He's doing? If God allows something in my life that I don't like, a financial catastrophe, I make a bad investment, I lose my job, if God allows a financial catastrophe in my life, can I get upset with God and say, God, you must change this, and God has to change it? He says, when God bends something, when God makes something crooked in your life, in other words, He allows some adversity in his sovereignty. Can you get upset with God and force God to change that? I can ask him to in prayer, but that's what prayer is. Prayer is asking. Prayer is not telling or commanding. If you ever end up in a church where they basically try and command God what he has to do in prayer, run from that church like the wind. Prayer is not telling God what he has to do. Prayer is asking. This is hard for us to swallow. To recognize the fact that as much as I think I'm on top of the world, and you ever have one of those Mondays? I know most Mondays probably aren't like that, but you get up and you're ready to hit, you got a new outfit and you're ready to go. You're on top of the world. You're ready for your presentation. And just when you think you're on top of the world, your car won't start. Oh, man. And God is subtly reminding us in his goodness. He's in charge. He's in control. We don't like not to be in control. And this is why we try and pretend like we are in control. All right, if I ignore this reality, maybe it'll go away. If I just really act confident and self-assured, maybe I can be the exception to this verse. And God says, who can straighten what God has bent? I can't overpower God. If I don't like something that God allows in my life, I can't walk up to heaven and find God and say, God, you need to change this now. I can't do that. And you can't do that. But we act like we can sometimes. Wow, that's frustrating. Or is it? Verse 14 is the hinge of this whole passage. Without verse 14, we'd probably walk away from here a little bit perplexed and wondering, why did I come here this morning? I should have just stayed in bed. Verse 14 explains it all. In the day of prosperity, be happy. And we don't see it in our English translation, depending on what English translation you have. But literally, in the Hebrew, it says, in the day of good things, be good. So he uses this key word, good, again here. He says, in the day of good things, be good. Specifically, in context, he's talking about economic prosperity. How appropriate for our church at this point, as we have several guys that are looking for work. Things were really good in Alberta, and then almost overnight, they changed. And our temptation is to be impatient. Our temptation is to get angry, to get frustrated with God, and say, God, you need to change this. And he says, in the day of good, enjoy it. Whether it's economic prosperity, whether it's blessing on the family, whether it's relationships that are being honored by God, whatever it is, success in school, he says, enjoy that. Be happy about that. Be glad and be thankful for that. And we like that part and we say, amen. In the day of good, be good. I can do that. I can really do that, Pastor Michael. I can swing that. Well, can you swing the next part? He says, in the day of adversity, consider this. Think about this. Okay, I don't like how this is going. God has made the one as well as the other. Oh, no. So what's he saying? That I have to accept the bad times just like I accept the good times. I like the good times. Keep them coming. But he says, in the bad times, in economic calamity, when you lose your job, when it's hard to find money to pay the bills, when things aren't going exactly as you wanted them to go, when, like Paul, you have some thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to beat you up. And we say, God, why on earth would you allow a messenger of Satan to beat me up? He says, remember, God's in charge of the good days, and He's also sovereign over the bad days, too. Now, we have to be careful here, because the Bible makes very clear that God is not the author of evil. He's not sitting in heaven looking down and thinking, wow, how can I mess up these people's lives? He's not the author of evil. But for some reason, in His wisdom and goodness, He allowed Satan to fall. He allowed Adam and Eve to bring disaster in the world through sin. And because of mankind's choice, we can expect to have many bad days with calamity and disaster. Hooray. Yay. Great. I can expect to have many bad days with calamity and disaster. That's what He says. And we think, well, God's in charge of the good days, but He must have lost control on the bad days. You ever have one of those days where you think, I'm not sure who's in control, but it sure doesn't seem like God. He says God is in control of the good days, and He's also in control of the bad days. He's got a sovereign plan, and in His sovereign plan, whether it's chastening for sin, whether it's a thorn in the flesh type issue to make us stronger and to grow, or pruning that He does in our lives as believers so that we can bear more fruit, whatever the purpose is for the bad that He allows in His sovereign plan, He says, you need to accept that. You need to throw down your arms and say, okay, God, that's okay. I don't like it. It hurts. Thorns are terrible little boogers, aren't they? You work in them, you're weeding around them, and you poke it, and it breaks off the rose bush, and it gets stuck in your finger. And if you don't get it out, it starts to get infected. Just a little thorn can make an immense amount of pain and discomfort. And you say, nobody understands what I'm going through. They look at it and they say, well, that's such a little thing. How can you be bothered by that? Get over it. Well, when you get a little thorn irritating your life, it can be incredibly annoying and painful. Whatever God's purpose in allowing it, you have one posture that you as a believer have to take. And that's the posture of, okay, God. You're God, I'm not. And if I had all your infinite wisdom, if I had all your infinite knowledge, then I would make the exact same choice for my life as you have made. So I'm going to say, okay, God, I don't understand. It hurts. I'd like for you to take it out of my life. But whatever you decide, you be God and I'll be your servant. He says God has made the one as well as the other. So enjoy the good days. Revel in the good days. Thank God for His goodness. It's good to have money with wisdom. But can you also accept the bad days as part of God's goodness as well? God would be a terrifying master to serve if we didn't know His heart. God would be a terrifying master to serve. To have somebody that has all power and can do whatever they want to do, that freaks us out. When you get a boss that has all this power, it makes you nervous because you don't know what they're going to do with it. When you have a dictator in a country that has all the power and all the control, it makes us very edgy because we don't know what they're going to do with it because we don't know their heart. But when you have a God who, as the demonstration of His love, says, here's my Son Jesus, and I give Him for you on the cross as a demonstration of my love, and all of a sudden the terror vanishes. Because that's somebody you can trust. If we didn't have the cross, then we would be fools to submit to a God like that. But because we have the cross, we know that we have a God who's not only in control, we have a God who's faithful and good and kind. My main problem in the Christian life is that I doubt God's goodness. Because I usually interpret God's goodness based on what's happening to me right now. If what's happening to me is good by my definition, then I've got a good God. I'll enjoy the good days. Yeah, this is great. Keep it coming. But on the bad days, I evaluate God based on what I think is good or bad. Do you do that? Maybe. Sometimes. I do it. And Solomon says, what's good? It's good to accept the bad days just like we accept the good days. Because they come from the same good God. So what's his point? What's he driving at? I believe the lesson for the day, the take-home truth for today, is that whether your life right now is good or bad, you've got one responsibility as a Christian: to live wisely, accepting God's plan. To live wisely, accepting God's plan. And I'll tell you what, friends, the last few weeks of my life, they sure haven't played out like I would have drawn them up. If I had the clipboard for my life in the timeout and I was drawing up the next play, the next segment, I wouldn't have drawn it up this way. I wouldn't have drawn it up, well, Michael goes to India with John Popola and he's over there preaching in five different churches and then he finds out that his son has broken his arm. That's not how I would have drawn it up. Or in John's case, John is there in India and he gets word that Neetha's going to have the C-section early and the baby's going to have to be taken early and he's got to try and scramble to find tickets to get home to see if he can make it in time to be with Neetha before she goes into surgery. If I was drawing up John's life, that's not what I would have chosen. But that's because I don't have all wisdom and knowledge. And the one who has all wisdom and knowledge says, this is the best. So in the good days and the bad days, live wisely, accepting that they're from the same God's hand. Would you bow your heads, please? He says it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise person than to hang out with fools. Are the influences that you're allowing in your life from wise people or foolish people? From wise movies or foolish movies? From wise music or foolish music? What are you allowing to influence your life? He says it's better to be patient than it is to be angry. Are you patient or are you angry? He says an impatient person is a proud person. He says it's good to have an inheritance, but it's better to have wisdom. Do you have wisdom, godly wisdom? He says it's good to accept the bad days, not just the good days. Do you rest in God's sovereignty, or do you buck against it and fight against it and squirm and wish that somehow you could get out of God's sovereign plan? All of us, I believe, in one way or another, need to respond to the Word of God. It's the climax here of our worship service. Maybe it's not confession of any sin. Maybe it's just a plea for God's mercy and grace to help you to continue to obey. But however you need to respond, you know that. Our Father in heaven, we are thankful that you rule over all, and no one can say to you, "What are you doing?" Your sovereignty is a wonderfully reassuring truth because you are faithful. You've demonstrated yourself to be a good king, and you always will be. So help us as your people not to fight against that sovereignty, not to wriggle our way out of it as if we could, And help us to rest in who you are. As the song says, simply trusting every day. Help us to trust. We pray in Jesus' name.